Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, well, you know, news of the economy is kind of rough, but we end with crossword puzzles, so that's something to look forward to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 24th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The very brief recap of the politics of this economic crisis is that the major indices and the algorithms that drive them took great heart today from indications that Congress and the White House have come to terms on a $1 trillion-plus economic rescue package. Rescue is probably a better word than stimulus, just as a random observation, because industry by industry indications are that there's not much activity left to stimulate. Restaurants and hospitality, moms and pops throughout this economy, big companies too, like airlines. So let us talk trade as a way into our news today, because with airlines all but shutting down, air freight is getting oh so much more expensive. Commercial airlines are trying to meet the demand, but that transformation from passengers to packages is not as simple as you might think. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour starts us off.
The price increases for air freight internationally are insane.
Along the London to US lanes, 128%, and along the Frankfurt to US lane, 109% increase over the last week.
Peter Stallion is a freight derivatives broker at FIS.
The prices have surged because the capacity available on passenger airlines is no longer running.
On a lot of international flights, passenger jets are also carrying cargo. Usually 80% of transatlantic cargo travels this way. Those passenger flights have evaporated. At the same time, demand has ramped up, for example, for medical supplies.
So we sort of have this perfect storm.
Neil Jones-Shaw is executive vice president for Flexport, an industrial shipping company. He says passenger airlines are taking advantage of surging cargo prices and adapting.
Most of the major airlines around the globe, they're all offering what they call mini freighters.
Loading up passenger planes with cargo. It is not an easy thing to do physically or economically. Samuel Engel is senior vice president at ICF.
Air freight is directional.
There's a lot more air freight that comes into the U.S. from China, for example, than the other way around.
So what you're asking is to use half of the plane, largely in one direction, to cover the costs or profit that would have been covered by the whole plane in both directions. That's a tall ask.
For now, prices are high enough for that to work. For now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The defining image, mental or actual, of this crisis so far, the healthcare crisis, to be clear here, is that of doctors and nurses and other first responders having to reuse their masks and the rest of their personal protective equipment. So American manufacturers, big and small, have been turning their factories and facilities to that task. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that one.
Last week, Kathleen Argiro got a request from a local hospital in New York City. She's a professor at the Fashion Institute of Technology and the chief product officer at Altris, a small company that makes dresses. The hospital wanted to know, could Altris make surgical masks?
The masks themselves are actually pretty easy to make, especially for an experienced sewer. They're really quite simple.
And the company is making 1,000 of them this week. Thing is, the Altris team usually works together. One person cuts, another sews, but since they're working from home...
Every sewer is doing every part of the process, so that is a huge challenge. It's just the logistics of having to sew in this way is not efficient at all.
Also, Altris, like Hanes and other apparel companies, is making surgical masks, which are not the ideal protection for doctors and nurses treating COVID patients. They often need heavier duty masks, N95s, which are in very short supply right now and are harder to make. Yogesh Behel at Alex Partners says you need special material, a type of polypropylene. And
One of the key things is you need the machines to actually make them. And one of the machines it required that can actually take polypropylene and convert it into the mask.
Those machines are also in high demand. The companies that make N95s, like 3M and Honeywell, are ramping up production. It's not clear whether they'll be able to meet the need. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, traders, as I said, found lots of things to cheer about once they forgot about the dire economics of a global pandemic. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pretty sure I've said this before, but it's worth a bit of repetition here because this time it's kind of different. You want to know how bad this recession that we are in is going to be? Keep your eyes on the labor market. The first real good peak at which we are going to get Thursday morning when we get a number called initial claims for unemployment insurance. It's going to be big this week, that number, maybe much as 10 times higher than normal. But beside the absolute value, first-time claims, as it's sometimes called, it can sometimes serve as a proxy for worker confidence in this economy because only a certain group of people who lose their jobs are going to file.
People who think that it's going to take them long enough to look for another job that they invest the time in filing the paperwork for unemployment benefits.
That's Tara Sinclair. She's an economist at George Washington University from an explainer on first-time claims that we did last fall. We have gotten her back on the phone to see what she is going to be looking for come Thursday morning's report. Professor Sinclair, welcome to the program.
Oh, great to be here.
So we had you on a number of months ago. We did an explainer on first-time claims. They are coming out again on Thursday, and they are expected to be enormous and incredibly distressing. Is it your sense that these numbers can hold up to the load that they're about to get?
Well, I mean, this is something that's never been tested before. If we think about what the highest numbers on record were, we're thinking, you know, under 700,000. And if we're believing some of the forecasts that are coming out from, you know, a lot of the banks, we might see numbers in the multiple millions. And so this is a load we've never seen before.
What does it mean in real life? What does it mean at the state unemployment office level, numbers like that?
Wow. So first of all, it means a lot of people under a lot of stress, both, you know, from the unemployment offices, as well as those individuals who are desperately trying to claim the benefits that they really need to be able to feed their families and pay their rent next month.
One of the things we learned from that explainer that we did with you is that people only go through the paperwork drill of filling out all this paperwork because it's not an easy thing to claim these benefits if they are reasonably confident that things are not going to pick up. Crystal ball this for me. And if the number is, as we've seen from some of the big banks on Wall Street and their analysts, 2.5 million, what does that tell you?
Well, I mean, this tells us that there are a lot of very desperate people out there right now, and they aren't optimistic that they're going to be able to find jobs. At the same time, we've got to remember that this is a very different situation than a traditional recession because, you know, people know that their companies have been closed down in order to protect people's health. So that's very different than normally when they're just thinking about their opportunities for jobs in a typical economy.
Well, I'm gonna go a little bit sideways here, but roll with me on this one.
Sure.
We've been saying now for 10 days, 2 weeks on this program that the economy is fundamentally shutting down. What's the restart going to look like? Is there a smooth way to turn things back on again?
Well, that's really something that we're hoping for, but it's not at all clear that that's what's going to happen. You know, all of the uncertainty that households are facing, that employers are facing, means that people can't make plans of any sort. And without being able to make plans, they don't know how to put things on hold because they don't know for how long it's going to be on hold. And all of that information would help people to be able to, you know, potentially have the economy rev back up more quickly. But if we don't know if it's going to be 3 months or 6 months or 12 months, that makes things much, much more difficult.
And obviously the same applies for businesses too, right? They're trying to make plans, figure out their investments, figure out their hiring policies, all that.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, what we're hearing anecdotally from some employers is they're saying, you know, we could cover payrolls for a month or two, but when we don't know when we're going to be able to bring people back to work and be able to sell our products again, that means that maybe it's better to go ahead and lay those people off so they can get unemployment benefits rather than try and keep them on our payrolls and have to lay them off in a couple of months. And, you know, that's a tough decision, you know, particularly for these small businesses who are really trying to figure out what their plans should look like.
Tara Sinclair, professor of economics at the George Washington University. Professor Sinclair, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to talk with you.
In a way, you lose your job, you don't care what the wordplay is, right? Maybe it's a furlough, maybe it's a layoff, maybe it's whatever, but what your employer calls it matters both for your personal economy and for the economy at large. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Jake Fever was working from home on Friday when he got the call.
It was pretty jarring. It's not like they had an office to call me into to give me the bad news. And after the phone call, I just kind of sat there like, did that really just happen?
His law firm in San Francisco put him on furlough. He'll have his salary and health insurance till the end of March. Then, who knows? The furlough doesn't have an end date.
It just feels like they don't really know what's going on. They don't really know how the future is going to be, and they're passing that uncertainty on to me.
A furlough is usually better than a layoff because it's temporary and often planned. For instance, some construction workers are put on furlough during winter. Jesse Rothstein directs the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley. He says right now, furlough, layoff, it's all kind of murky.
I think for most small and medium-sized businesses, they kind of are the same thing right now, because I don't think any business can be confident it's going to come back in the same form.
There are still pluses to being furloughed as opposed to being laid off. You don't have to show the state you're looking for work to collect unemployment benefits, because technically you still have a job. And Heidi Scherholz at the Economic Policy Institute says furloughs are good for employers, too. They won't have to spend so much time and money replacing workers later on.
When the threat of the coronavirus is over, we could just get the economy back online really quickly.
And she says there's a bigger takeaway here. Furloughs mean businesses are still somewhat optimistic about the economy. If we see the needle swing toward layoffs, it means business confidence is falling. But what about worker confidence?
I'm treating it as a layoff. I mean, I've been telling people in my life that it's a layoff.
Jake Fever, the lawyer in San Francisco, is job hunting. And if he's still, quote unquote, furloughed in 2 months, he'll move in with his parents in San Diego. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The crossword is this anchor in all times, good times, but almost especially times of stress and crisis.
Also, they are conducive to social distancing. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, here it is again, our old friend, the sad, happy music. The Dow Industrials up 2,112 points today, 11.3%. Finished at 20,704. The NASDAQ up 557. That is 8.12%. Ended things at 74.17. The S&P 500 increased 209 points, 9.3%, 24.47. Just listen to music for a minute, would you? All right, there you go. World demand for air cargo, as Sabri was talking about, continues. Sent prices up. FedEx delivered more than 7% today. UPS found more than 3% on the day. Marielle reported some fashion and clothing companies are pivoting to making masks. Hanes confirmed its retrofitting factories to make masks. Sewed up just 0.2% on that news. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So here is a business dilemma made more acute in this coronavirus economy. Your company makes a product that can get pretty expensive. Your manufacturing overhead is huge, not to mention labor costs. Your competition is as cutthroat as you are, so you have got to keep people buying. Car makers are aware of we speak. They are cranking up incentive programs, hoping to get would-be buyers in the door, even with all the uncertainty. Buy a car now is one offer and pay nothing for 6 months. Or how about 7 years of interest-free financing? The big automakers offered similar deals back during the financial crisis. Marketplace's Jack Stewart's been looking into how well they are likely to work this time.
2020 was forecast to be a pretty good year again for car makers. Eric Lyman at TrueCar had estimated new vehicle sales would total 17 million, but he has adjusted that down hard.
We're expecting to land somewhere around 13.2 million in the most sort of likely outcome.
Automakers need to keep sales up to keep cash flowing, so they're offering big incentives, and not just cheap deals and low and zero interest financing, but flexibility.
Buy a new Ford. We'll defer 3 payments and make 3 payments for peace of mind up to 6 months.
Most of the mid-market automakers are making offers like Ford's.
They're very similar to what we saw back in 2009 and 2010 as the market crashed.
That's Jim Houston, who monitors consumer lending and auto finance at JD Power. He says there is a big difference this time. Back then, some finance companies were folding. For now, at least, lenders have plenty of available credit. Auto analyst Rebecca Lindland says car makers are also making these finance offers, in part at least, to support their local dealerships.
If a dealer goes out of business, it really negatively affects the community in which that dealer usually worked.
While these incentives could lead to great deals on new cars for some shoppers, Lindland also warns that buyers should tread carefully. 6 months may not turn out to be much of a buffer for people who lose their jobs. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We had Ben Bernanke on the program yesterday. Speaking of which, get the podcast if you missed that on air. But anyway, Bernanke, late of the Federal Reserve, as I'm sure you know, said something interesting that I wanted to go back to for a second.
We're not yet in a financial crisis, but we are in a situation where it's important to make the credit markets work as well as possible. We don't want this period of shutdown to do permanent damage.
One thing among many that the Fed is doing to keep credit markets working is injecting tons of money into something called the repo market. And because it's dead, shall we say, weedy, we have been getting lots of questions about it. So the repo markets are, for lack of a better word, the guts of the financial system. They help banks and other financial institutions get their hands on short-term cash that they need for daily operations. The secret here is that banks and all the rest of them don't really like holding cash if they don't have to. They would much rather keep something like treasury bonds that earn at least a little bit of return. But they need cash to pay their employees or their taxes or to settle trades. So they sell treasuries to get the cash by agreeing to repurchase those treasuries the next day. Repurchase. Repo. Get it? Repo? Anyway, we did an explainer on the repo market back in October. The Fed had just had to step in and smooth things out. And we got Beth Hammack on the phone. She is the global treasurer at Goldman Sachs, also, by the way, used to run their repo trading desk.
Think about it as if you were going bowling.
Okay, go ahead.
You'd walk up to the counter and you're wearing your fancy shoes. You need to deposit your shoes at that counter and they'll give you bowling shoes that you can borrow. You pay a small fee to do that, but they have your shoes as collateral against the bowling shoes they've given you.
Rolling with that analogy, then, you're the financial institution, the bank, the hedge fund, whatever, that needs some short-term cash. So you trade your treasuries, your shoes.
If I need to make payroll, I can't make that with treasuries. I make that with cash.
So to the bowling alley we go.
The bowling alley is the financial market.
That is anybody who's got a bunch of cash to lend overnight.
The bowling shoes are cash or reserves.
Your shoes, the ones you trade in?
My shoes are the collateral, or in this case, the treasuries that I'm putting in.
And also,
the fee I pay to borrow those bowling shoes, that's the repo rate.
So those are the basics on repo, as explained last fall when things were calm in comparison to today. What you need to bear in mind, though, and why the Federal Reserve is doing so much to make sure the credit markets work and the repo market specifically, is that in the coming weeks and maybe months, yeah, a whole lot of businesses, from big Wall Street banks to small and medium-sized companies, are going to need cash to keep running while their revenues slow down. Through wars and recessions and, yes, pandemics, crossword puzzles have helped people forget hard times, even if only for as long as it takes to figure out a three-letter word for a public radio host's name, first letter K. Anyway, what started as a way newspapers used to fill space back in 1913 has become an institution in and of itself. Adrian Raffel's new book, exploring the economic and social history of the crossword puzzle, is called Thinking Inside the Box. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's not like crosswords are highbrow now, right? But you gotta have a little oomph to really figure them out. Back in the day, they were a little trashy.
Yeah, this is something I totally love about when crosswords are sort of a super fad in the 1920s. There's all these newspaper articles lamenting, oh my God, people are just coming into the libraries to just, you know, steal our dictionaries and scrawl all over and do these puzzles, and nobody's reading great book literature anymore, and the crossword is going to be just the ruination of culture and rot our brains.
A note here that the New York Times, now basically synonymous with crosswords, took a while to decide it wanted to publish them.
And that's a fascinating and I think actually pretty timely story given when they started publishing them, which was February 1942 because of Pearl Harbor. And an editor writes to the publisher and says, you know, those crosswords that we've been poo-pooing for these years, well, people need something that is not these bleak headlines in the newspaper. They need something else to read in our paper. Turns out the publisher had been sort of sneakily doing the rival crosswords on the side. So, you know, twist his arm. But yeah, I think it's so telling that the crossword is this robust anchor in all times, good times, but almost especially times of stress and crisis.
Interesting also that it's kind of a distraction a lot along the lines of how we use our phones now, right?
And the digital app, the crossword, keeps getting stronger on the phone. And there's lots of apps for the crossword. Mm-hmm. And I'm playing when I'm standing in line somewhere. I like it better than other things on my phone, you know?
Fair enough. One cannot mention crossword puzzles on public radio without talking about Will Shortz, the puzzle editor of the New York Times, and whatever it is on Weekend Edition, to which, you know, I listen every now and then. Among the many things that he has sort of institutionalized in the world of crosswords, my favorite little tidbit from this book is that he's the guy who really codified the gradient difficulty levels from Monday through Sunday in the Times crosswords.
Yeah, that had been starting when he took over as editor in 1993, but he really sharpened that up and they think really hard about, okay, is this, you know, a tough Monday? Is this, or is this an easy Tuesday? Or is this a medium Wednesday? It's become like a sort of unofficial gradient to really a way that people understand how the crossword works.
And also a method, and I thought this was totally fascinating, a method of inclusion, right? Because, I mean, I would get clobbered by the Sunday Times, but I can do like a Monday, Tuesday pretty easily and feel pretty good about myself.
I think that's so great, you know, that there's a home for everybody in the crossword. And the beauty of it is you can start at any level and the crossword's there for you.
Adrian Raffel, her book is called Thinking Inside the Box. Adrian, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
You can learn more about how crossword puzzles ended up in the New York Times and an excerpt from Adrian's book. It is, of course, at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a little pandemic data journalism from the Wall Street Journal. The paper dug into data industry by industry to find out, in essence, what is selling now and what is not. Here are some highlights or lowlights, depending on how you're looking at this. Spending on leisure activities down 35% on an annual basis. And that's as of March 13th, by the way. So it's probably worse. In fact, definitely worse now. From Yelp data, these tidbits. More interest in pizzerias and fresh produce makes sense. Less interest in cafes and wineries. They both make sense. Gelato shops, I don't get it, but not interested. Up, video conferencing, also digital news consumption, which leads me to this. Have I mentioned we have a podcast? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 2,112 points, 11.3% today. The NASDAQ up 557, that is 8.1%. The S&P 500 increased 209 points, 9.3% there. Our digital and on-demand theme includes Ufukme Badolu, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Cesar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.